You are now listening to the Someone's Favorite Productions podcast network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to New World Pictures Podcast. And welcome to Corman Graduates, our series where we examine the filmography of some of the graduates of Corman's School of Filmmaking. And we are on episode 4 of Jack Hill. And we're so excited to talk about these two movies. I'm Ryan. With me, as always, is Mark.
Hey, thanks for inviting me.
You're a co-host, Mark. You're always invited. And Erica.
Thanks for inviting Mark, because then Mark invited me.
So. You guys are both always invited. That's why I say always.
You're welcome, Erica. Anyway, glad you got my email.
And joining us, we have a terrific guest. We're so excited to have on the show for the first time. He is a writer and author of Black Caesars and Foxy Cleopatra's. Welcome to the show, Odie Henderson.
Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, thank you for being here. I'm really enjoying this book. This is a great, it's a history of Black exploitation cinema, and it is so in depth, and I love the research you've done on it. I love the way you've broken up the book into years, and it's for anybody that enjoys exploitation films, Black exploitation films, this is a must own. It's a terrific book.
Thank you so much.
Can I ask you, like, when did you first start thinking about writing this book?
Well, for years, I had done a little February event on my blog, Big Media Vandalism, my old blog, called Black History Month, MUMF on purpose. And it was about movies that I grew up watching, Black movies that I grew up watching as a kid. And a lot of these essays I had written, nobody was really writing about Blaxploitation or coffee or any of these things back in 2008 when I started doing this. So it was kind of a big piece. And I started writing, it's just about movies that I grew up watching. What do I remember about them? What were they like rewatching them as an adult, you know, as an older adult, than, you know, instead of a teenager or a kid? And from there, it kind of started to grow. It got popular. That's how I wound up at RogerEbert.com for 11 years. Roger's editor loved my work at Big Media Vandalism. And so I had to promote it. So I was writing on these essays, and several of them kind of got reworked for the book simply because I had been writing about coffee and about Cooley High and all these movies I saw as a kid. And even later on when I worked in the video store that I could rent, because you know not all of them were on television.
Right.
And if they were, they'd be pretty cut up. So the video store era was kind of when I really got immersed in Blaxploitation at a time when I could fully understand it as a teenager, a college kid. But I mean, I saw a lot of these movies. I saw the double feature of the movies they're talking about, Coffee and Foxy Brown, at the Pix Theater in Jersey City in 1976. I was too young to see these movies.
Yeah.
But
they're not for kids.
They are not for children in any regard. But, you know, sometimes you have an auntie or you have an older cousin that takes you to the movies that your mom would scream her head off if she found out you saw.
Yep.
So when the time came, I was trying to pitch a book on Michael Schultz, the director who directed Cooley High and Car Wash and a bunch of other things. And at one point was one of the premier Black directors in Hollywood in the 70s. And it kind of morphed into this book. When someone had asked if I would be interested in pitching a Blaxploitation book, because there aren't very many out there.
No.
And I thought, okay, I could actually do this because I've written so much about it over the years. It's a genre I love, I have affection for. And this was just me going back and putting all the research in to understand when the movies were made, how they were made, why they were made, and so on. And also to look at them as an old man. You know, I was introduced to Foxy Brown and Coffee in 76. And then, of course, when it came to the video era, you know, there were very popular rentals in the video store. Our video store catered to Blaxploitation, Kung Fu movies, Cantinflas movies, and porn. That's how we stayed open as a little video store.
Porn's how almost every non-major, you know, blockbuster
the
Hollywood
Kung
video.
Fu, the Kung Fu and Blaxploitation movies were just as popular as the porn because Blockbuster wasn't renting any of the three things I just said.
No.
At all.
Yeah.
So, you know, our store stayed open. So as a teenager, I was reintroduced to these films. I looked at them as a teenager. And now, you know, as a middle-aged old guy, I wanted to look at them again and see, what did I learn from them? What did I glean from them as a kid? Was it harmful? Was it helpful? Are the movies still good? You know, look back at them and see some of the history that they made. And, you know, with Coffee, it's especially historic because you have a woman action hero. Not just a Black woman action hero, woman action hero. It's very rare. You know, since you guys do this podcast, you know, you're familiar with Roger Corman's things like Big Bad Mama and some of these other movies, but they're not the standard. They're aberrations at this time.
Right. Yep. Right. Yeah, and you have a chapter in your book that I thought was particularly fascinating because you talked about the Citizen Kane of Blaxploitation. And the movie you chose for that, I found kind of surprising. It's a great film, but I was surprised that Superfly, you think, is the that's the Citizen Kane of the genre.
Yeah, and the reason why, there's a couple of reasons. One, the blaxploitation genre is called blaxploitation because of Superfly. The head of the NAACP, he coined the term after Superfly was released. And the whole blaxploitation, anti-blaxploitation movement, which was going on since 1970, 71, particularly with Shaft, this was kind of the movie that turned the corner on that really got them involved in trying to ban blaxploitation films. Also, Superfly, unlike some of the two movies we're going to talk about, there's an immorality to both the movies we're going to talk about, even a little nihilism to it. But Superfly forces you to make a decision about that. Superfly is a movie about a guy who is selling drugs and he wants to make one big score, typical heist, plot, to get out of the game. But what you know when you find out is that he doesn't need another score. He's already got 700 grand in the bank. This is 1972 money, by the way, we're talking about,
Yeah,
right?
that's a significant amount at that time.
And he wants to do one more score to get up to a whole million. Now, the way he does that is he sells drugs, and he sells drugs to the black community for the most part. So if you are for him, you are, buying into this thing that he's selling drugs to the black community. If you're against him, you're for the capitalist machine that's forcing him to sell drugs. So that's why I think the immorality of Superfly is fascinating, and nor are the movies that complicated. And then also on top of that, you have Curtis Mayfield's score, which kicked off the entire, I mean, Sweet Sweetback started it. Let's give Melvin credit of putting a soundtrack album out to promote the film. Superfly brought it into the stratosphere because, one, Curtis could sing, Melvin couldn't. And two, Superfly made more money, the album made more money than the movie did.
Yeah, the soundtrack is one of the great s scores of all time. It's just an
Right.
absolute banger of a, I mean, song after song. It's so good.
Yeah, and so Shaft got the Oscar, but Superfly kind of brought into the whole concept of you have to have a soundtrack album for your films, something that blaxploitation became known for. And then with Saturday Night Fever kicking it off, making a huge soundtrack that was the number one soundtrack for decades, and then Flashdance making it almost impossible for you not to have a soundtrack. All those things come into play. So Superfly is important in that regard. I also think it's the best movie quality-wise of the blaxploitation era. There are movies that are more lizard brain fun and movies that are just, trash outright that are also kind of fun. But this movie seems to put everything together, and that's why I called it the Citizen Kane of blaxploitation. I kind of stand by that. I
No,
mean,
I.
the Holy Trinity of blaxploitation is Shaft, Superfly, and Coffee. So Coffee winds up in here somehow.
Yeah. No, I actually love that you wrote that. I mean, I was expecting probably once I started reading it, I was thinking maybe Shaft, maybe it's going to be somewhere around there. And then to have Superfly, I thought, wow, that's a bold pick. And reading your, I mean, I can't disagree with any of your logic. I love that you kind of talk about like the big one of the bigger characters is even the soundtrack to that. And it's like because it is it almost casts a shadow on the movie itself because it's just
It's, yeah.
such it was such a big soundtrack and
And it's
it's.
contrapuntal also because you have people selling drugs on the soundtrack. You got Curtis Mayfield telling you Freddie's dead. So it's working. Curtis Mayfield said it was a commercial for cocaine. So he said, I'm going to try to combat that in a little bit of a way by kind of making it sexy, but also telling you, giving you a cautionary tale on the soundtrack. So the movie is at odds with itself, just like you're at odds with how who you choose as your hero.
Yeah, and it's a great movie. I do love a movie, and I you know it's a but I was a little surprised at the pick. I'm not gonna lie. I was a little, but I love that you chose that one. It's great. It's a great pick.
You weren't the only person surprised. Someone was my editor.
But we are here to talk about two different movies and what I would actually call the AIP phase of Jack Hill's career, but it's impossible to not also say the Pam Grier phase, even though he just made two movies with Pam Grier, but this feels like the real Jack Hill Pam Grier combination with Coffee and Foxy Brown. And so the first time you saw it was 1976. The first time I saw it, Coffee, I actually saw it in a movie theater. I saw it in San Francisco at the Red Vic on, it's no longer there, but it was on Haight Street. And it was just one of those, you know, I watched a bunch of, they had a bunch of movies there. I saw Dolomite there. I saw Human Tornado. I saw Superfly TNT. I saw a bunch of movies at
Sorry.
the you sort of grimaced at Superfly TNT, but I hadn't seen Superfly TNT. And to your point, like there was one really great video store in San Francisco where I was going to college at the time. And that's where I could rent them. You couldn't rent them anywhere else. I even worked at a tiny little, you know, mom pa video store. We didn't have tons of those titles, so you had to go into the city to actually rent that or any of the Italian zombie films and all that kind of stuff. That's where you
Right.
got that stuff, kung fu stuff, all that stuff. You had to get it there, and that's
And it
where I
was
got it.
largely copies of VHS
Oh, we
because,
had that too. That's why we got raided. I didn't say that in the book. I couldn't say that in the book, but I could say it now. Yeah, we got raided.
Oh, I mean, that stuff happened, and you could w rent like weird stuff. Like they had like a work print. This is off topic, but a work print of like Spinal Tap, which was uncut, and it was like 4 or 5 hours long. And it's literally somebody they're shooting it on video, and somebody's putting
Playing
it up
it.
against a screen,
So you can
and
rec Oh my God.
you're watching that, and it's like 4 or 5 hours long, and it's in one of the worst ways you could watch it, but I did because you could rent it, and it was like that. They didn't have Superfly TNT, so I got to see that in a movie theater, and it's not as good as the original. That's just to put it lightly. Erica, Mark, is this your first time watching the movie, or had you guys seen it before?
I had seen it back in college from the same video. I think we got it from Lay Video at the time because we went through a period of watching a lot of exploitation movies and blaxploitation movies, and this was one of them. But I hadn't seen it in so long that it was almost like watching it all over again. And, not that we're at final questions yet, but.
We don't do that in this one,
Oh,
but okay.
yeah, I think we will. But I was maybe it's because we've watched a succession of really questionable movies leading up to this recording, and maybe it was some of that. But from minute one, and I want to know from you guys, I mean, this movie establishes a character right at the beginning, but doesn't give you all the information around this character, but it has a very bold opening.
Oh, sure.
And I was in.
Oh, yeah.
And did you have the same kind of, I mean, from the cinematography, the camera moving in the bar scene at the very beginning, like it really pulls you in. And I, maybe it's just me watching a succession of bad movies, or it really did have that same effect on people because it locked me in from like the first 5 minutes.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah, well, I mean, that opening with the opening shot of her being inside the limo to then going to the guy's house and then pulling the shotgun, and the way they have that shot of her holding the shotgun where they've just lit her eyes and you could just see her eyes all lit up. I
That's
mean,
iconic.
that's an unbelievable
Yeah,
shot.
it is.
And it's there on your book. It's there on your book.
That's my contribution to the cover. I asked him to put that silhouette on there. Everything else came from the guy that designed the cover, and God bless him. He did a fantastic job.
But yeah, that shot of her holding a shotgun was
It's
that's
iconic.
yeah, it's it, and it's a that scene, which, you know, he actually learned a lot from New World to do that shot, because in order to do that shot with a shotgun, he put plexiglass up in front of the actor that who gets got there. Which is exactly what he did in Big Dollhouse when they had the snake that, you know, and they put plexiglass on top so she would feel safe being basically naked on a table with a snake coming down on top of her. So that's the same
She
trick he
said it
did.
didn't help. It scared the hell. She said it did not help. She was
No.
terrified.
Yeah, no,
Can't
it'd
blame her for
still be
that
scary. It'd
with a
still be
snake.
scary. Incredible shot. And if you're not on board, then this is not your type of movie.
It lets you know early what you're in for. It lets you know very early what you're in for.
And
And
is this your first time seeing it?
it is. I mean, listeners will know that I haven't seen much. So typically New World and everything else that we've been able to watch and explore is all kind of a learning experience for me. So I had not seen this before. And I agree with you, Mark. I was locked in. I'm like, okay, well, here we go. This is terrific.
My name's Carter. I know what you want to, and you're gonna get it. This is the end of your rotten life, you dope pusher!
But to talk about the opening, just how it grabs you, this is important because there's a couple of things that Jack Hill establishes in the opening of this film, which was shot in January, February of 73 in Los Angeles. And so Pam Grier, as you know, she was working at AIP as the receptionist. And when she went to make the big dollhouse and the big bird cage and women in cages in the Philippines, the three movies she made when she first went to the Philippines, and Pam Grier is of Filipino descent. So her grandfather told her to say hi to your relatives when you're out there. When she came back, she went back to work at AIP, and they're like, "What are you doing? You are a star now." I'm like, she's like, "No, I'm not. I gotta save this money to go to school."
She
And
wanted to
of
go to
course,
film school,
she wanted
right?
to go
I
to film
mean,
school.
yeah.
And so Coffee was the movie that kind of blew that completely out of the water, where now you can't go back to work at AIP. But the opening of Coffee is a rope-a-dope, and I'll tell you why. Because before Coffee, women in movies, and especially in blaxploitation movies, serve one of three purposes. They serve the purpose to bring some information to the hero, to screw the hero, or to die. And they did not have agency. So Coffee sets it up exactly like that. She's supposed to be doped up on drugs. She's high. She's going to bring these two guys back to their place. They think they're going to get some sex and some drugs. And then she pulls a shotgun out of nowhere because where the hell does she have that shotgun? Anyway, it sets you up for what you think is going to be some kind of groovy sex scene where the woman is just objectified. And then she pulls out that shotgun. And all of a sudden, everybody in the theater was like, "Holy shit, no." And then they're, "Holy shit, yes." I've had the opportunity to show Coffee in Poland. I did, long before I did this, I did a nine film series on African American cinema in Poland, the Off Plus Camera Film Festival. And I had double features, or ideas that were double features. I got a ninth movie, so I kind of threw everything out of whack. But I showed Coffee and Jackie Brown, Quentin Tarantino sent a 35 millimeter print of Jackie Brown, because we couldn't show Foxy Brown because I don't think the rights were available.
Oh, okay.
For Coffee. So we showed Coffee and Foxy. Every movie I showed, I wrote about in this book, Coffee and Foxy Brown. We showed Shaft and Devil in the Blue Dress as the detective movies. We showed Waiting to Exhale and Claudine as the quote unquote women's pictures. And we showed, what else did we show? Oh, well, we showed Hollywood Shuffle, which makes fun of everything I just
Love that
said.
movie. Love that movie.
And so Coffee was, they had a Blu-ray of Coffee. And I was like, I objected to this. I said, "Coffee should look like it got run over by a truck and then run through the projector. It looked too good." But our showing of Coffee was standing room only. People stood up to watch Coffee. And I was just stunned that in a foreign country that people were, and they were into it. Like, we also showed it at Film Forum. In fact, I'm doing an introduction to Coffee on the 30th of August, because they're doing a whole series on women action heroes. So they did a whole thing on blaxploitation last year with my book. And I introduced a whole bunch of Pam Grier movies and Willie Dynamite. But they're showing Coffee, a whole day of Pam. They're showing Coffee, Foxy Brown, Jackie Brown, and the Big Dollhouse. And I'm introducing Coffee and the Big Dollhouse. And the Film Forum is, snooty art house theater. But, there's a grindhouse element to it that Bruce Goldstein kind of brings sometimes to it. And Coffee, I mean, it was gangbusters. So it plays great no matter what. And of course, I don't know if you know this, but Coffee is short for something. Did you know that her
No,
name is
her
actually not
coffin.
Coffee? It's Nurse Coffin. She has no first name. She's like Mr. T. She has no first name. But I didn't know that her name was Coffin until I started researching this book. That I found out her name is Nurse Coffin, and she's an angel of death. So that opening, like you mentioned, is Hill kind of, I think, Hill at his best in terms of setting the stage for something and then pulling the rug out from under you. It goes back to what's the movie he made, Spider Baby, in the 60s. And there's a similar kind of element to that as well,
Yeah,
and
for
in terms
sure.
of things that he did. So when we get to Foxy Brown, we can talk a little more about Jack Hill's anger. at the studio, but staying with coffee, you know.
When you're talking about coffee, trying, and I did see, when I saw it in that little theater on Haight Street, it was one of those prints that had like a real red tint to it, and it was not looking that great, but it was a, so I'm assuming you don't have the 4K, the new 4K. Oh, you got it. You got it. You got it.
You know, I'm in a documentary in this on that box set, you know.
You are, yes.
I'm on a documentary and then a new box set. I'm also in a documentary and a new box set that's coming out with Foxy Brown in it as part of it. So yeah, I got it.
Yep.
I'll
I
never
also
watch it
got
because it looks too good. No.
the umbrella. It does look too good, but I also have the umbrella Blu-ray as well, which came out right beforehand. So I got this, and then they put out that 4K set, Chow did, and I was like, well, I got to have that. Plus, across 110th Street is to have that on 4K. I'd only
Oh
had an old
yeah.
DVD, and I love that movie. So I was like, okay, well, I got to get all these. So. But yeah, I saw that documentary. You're great in it.
Thank you.
But I just want to talk about Jack getting involved in this because he had finished two movies for New World Pictures, and he ends up going to AIP, which is interesting because that's, of course, where Roger had worked for so long and eventually got sick of and started New World Pictures. And so Jack then goes to them. And this is from Callum Waddell's book, but he said that coffee wasn't something I wanted to do. I had an agent at the time, and he said to me that AIP was looking for somebody to do a picture. Now, I was familiar with AIP because of Roger's movies that had been released through them, and I had this meeting with Larry Gordon, who ran the studio, and I didn't know that they wanted what they wanted me to make. It turned out to be a black film, and my heart kind of sank because I didn't feel that this was a genre that I knew how to deal with or even wanted to deal with. But when Larry said it was to be a black woman, I thought that it would be an opportunity to do something really, really good with Pam Grier. So once I got into it, started working on it, I became really enthusiastic. Now that's Jack in Callum's book, but I found this interesting because in Pam Grier's book, Foxy, she doesn't talk a ton about the movies that she made, particularly with New World, or with the exception of The Arena, which she does sort of after Foxy Brown. But she said this about it because this movie also gets made because of Cleopatra Jones. And AIP was going to make that, and then they missed out on it. And it went to Warner Brothers, and they got a better deal there. So then they wanted to make something in lieu of that. But in her book, Pam Grier says, while Tamara, who played Cleopatra Jones, shot her most famous film, Cleopatra Jones, I was hired for a role where I finally made some real money. It was the part of a woman named Coffee in a movie of the same name, which had originally been written for a white woman. She had turned it down, however, because she was not willing to do her own stunts, and stunt work can be so dangerous. So I didn't realize that. And that's not something that Jack is saying. He's sort of saying, like, oh, it's gonna be, I'm gonna hire Pam then. But apparently not. So I don't know. Did you know in researching the book, like,
Well, it seems to be kind of a merging of both things. There's this truth in both sides, both stories. There's truth in both stories. And I'm sure that the coffee was written for a white woman initially, but that probably wasn't Jack Hill's idea because it Jack Hill, even in Pam Grier's book, she mentions that, he thought she was a great actor. He said she had it, that she had presence, that she could really command the screen, which is, of course, absolutely 100% true.
Yep, he's not
And so
wrong.
Cleopatra Jones was actually pitched. Max Julian, who was the co-writer of Cleopatra Jones, who would later become the Mac, Goldie, to us Blaxploitation fans. He had written Cleopatra Jones, and he was going to sell it to AIP because AIP would have been the studio that would have made a movie like Cleopatra Jones. Warner Brothers would not have. And it turned out they turned him down or whatever the case was. He wound up at Warner Brothers and got a better deal. So AIP said, now we need to hurry up and make a movie with a black woman in it so we can try to undercut Cleopatra Jones. And so there's some truth to both sides of the story. And I think Jack Hill would have been happy to have had Pam Grier to write a piece for her. I mean, obviously Foxy Brown is written for her. But I think that there's some truth to that. It's possibly initially, at least the story may have been designed for a white woman. Now what it became was obviously something that he wrote for Pam Grier. He shaped it with Pam because she gave some input into the script. She talks about that in her book as well. She put some input into the script that Black Jack Hill kept asking her, what, because he's not a black director, what would you do? Or what would this person do? And so she offered that information. So I think it's the I think it's a merging of those two stories in some way.
Yeah, I mean, because he definitely crafts it around Pam Coffey, that is, both films really, but Coffey for sure, because, and he will give her all the credit for one of the absolute best scenes, which is her putting the razor blades
Razor
in
blades in
her,
the hair.
which is her idea,
That was her idea.
and unbelievable. I'll never forget having seen the movie in a theater, and the crowd reaction to that scene was unbelievable, and it has stuck with me ever since. It's just an unbelievable
Now,
scene.
imagine that scene with a whole group of rowdy black people at a second run theater in 1976 with afros. Imagine that scene played. Now, I had an afro, obviously, and I wouldn't have been able to put a paperclip in mine because the back of it was so thin. So I envy her because in Foxy Brown, she's got a gun in her afro.
I mean, it's an unbelievable scene, and also just using the paperclip and just sharpening it to become a weapon. That's all Pam. That's all Pam's ideas. So, and I would say I'm interested in your thoughts, but thinking that we had just seen Big Dollhouse and Big Birdcage, I actually feel this is a real natural progression in a way for Pam Grier. Obviously, not in ways that I think audiences were exactly prepared for at the time, but it's sort of, she plays such a badass, tough lady in Big Dollhouse,
She's
and
Greer. Her name is Greer in that movie.
Grier, yeah, which is a great irony. And she plays such a badass in that, and then when it comes to Big Birdcage, she's again a revolutionary, but she like goes into the prison sort of undercover, and so like all of those elements kind of play right into Coffee, and it seems like a real natural progression, and luckily in the hands of somebody who really knows how to write for her.
Well, look at the progression of the movies between what you just said and Coffee. So you have her doing those movies, and you have her doing Hitman, which is a fantastic take on the Get Carter. It's close, it's actually more faithful to the book than Get
Oh,
Carter
okay.
is. An extremely violent movie, and probably the last movie where Pam Grier gets killed, by the way. And then you have her doing Twilight People, where she's a half panther, half woman. And you have her doing a movie that's one of my favorites, Black Mama, White Mama, with Mark and Markoff, that Jonathan Demme was one of the co-writers of it, and Joe Dante edited. And so that was like her first quote-unquote lead. And this progression of her being, this tough woman who is actually, in Hitman, a villain, kind of, sort of. And then in Twilight People, she's a killer panther. And then in this movie, she's a revolutionary, but she's also on equal footing with her character. I wish she and Margaret Marco had made more movies together, to be honest with you. They were just great. The chemistry was great between the two of them. They only did two movies. But so you have that. And then now we have Coffee. So she's proven herself, because Black Mama, White Mama made money. She proves herself as a lead. And now we have Coffee, so that kind of justifies her being in this. All these movies that she's made have been little elements of who Nurse Coffin turned out to be.
She'd also been a villain in Women in Cages,
Yeah,
which
she
is
was a
another one
woman
of the
in, right.
Philippine movies, and it's we will again on this podcast we'll eventually get to Twilight People and Black Mama White Mama, because those were initially going to be New World movies. Twilight People was made for it, and it eventually goes to Larry Wilner, who leaves New World and starts Dimension in the early 70s, so that he takes that movie with him. And then Jonathan Demme brought the script to Roger, and he was like, just take it to AIP to see what they think. You guys can go sell it somewhere. And I'm like, what a miss on that one. A huge miss. That's not rare for Roger to have that kind of miss and not recognize that he had a great hit on his hands. But yeah, rare miss. But yeah, she does. She's definitely put in the time. Her time in the Philippines, she did a ton of work, and she's like ready. She's certainly ready for this moment. And like you said, soundtracks are huge. These two movies, interestingly, Jack Hill has less say in terms of the editing and the soundtrack, but he gets two great scores out of this regardless. I think Roy Ayers is re his soundtrack is underrated for Coffee. The theme song for it is terrific. That great shot at night of going down, I think it's Wilshire
Wilshire. It's Wilshire. It's
Boulevard.
Wilshire.
And another thing that I think is a huge underrated element of Coffee is cinematographer Paul Lohmann. He only worked with Jack on this one film, but he kind of goes on and works with Altman, Robert Altman. He works on Nashville. He eventually does a movie for New World, Lust of the Dust, in the 80s.
Oh, Paul Bartel and Divine. That's a fun movie.
That is. It is. It is a
And
really
Tab
fun movie.
Hunter, right? Tab Hunter is in that too, right?
And Paul does a great job with the cinematography on Coffee, especially just playing it next to Foxy Brown, just because we'd watched it for this. It's such a stark contrast.
It
The
is.
cinematography, it's like what Paul's doing in that movie in Coffee is just, it's miles above Foxy Brown.
And it's the, I think the last shot of her walking around the beach is very exceptionally well framed and well shot little last piece of the film, and several other things, the whole LA, the freeway kind of sequence with Sid Haig and those folks. It's shot better than you remember. And it doesn't help. The one thing it doesn't help is, of course, King George's eye-searing yellow outfit that Ruth Carter made fun of when she did "I'm Gonna Get You, Sucker." I interviewed Ruth Carter and I asked her about the fish in Antonio Fargas's shoes. And Chris, we'll talk about Fargas with Foxy Brown. And she told me that it was in the script that Keenan Ivory Wayans had said that Antonio Fargas is gonna have fish in his shoes because there was a giant New York Giants player in the 70s named Frenchy Fuqua, who had fish in his shoes. And so it was funny that she and Keenan had the same memory. And she put the shit, it was an honor to put fish in Antonio Fargas' shoes. But the soundtrack of Coffee, with Roy Ayers being the vibraphonist and great, and the whole King George song. Whenever I sign a book for someone named George, I have to sing it. George, George, King George, he's the player.
It's a great song. Like he really, and King George is a hugely iconic character. Like that outfit when he steps out, it's just like it's unbelievable. What a great character.
And in RoboCop, when I saw RoboCop, I'm like, it's King George. It's Robert RoboCop, he's the police chief, right?
Yeah, that actor, Robert DeCoy or DeCuy. Okay, I didn't know if I was gonna say that right. He didn't do like a ton of blaxploitation films, because I remember him, and he actually ends up going to Nashville and being in Robert Altman's movie with Paul Lohman, the cinematographer. But he didn't do like a ton of those kinds of movies, and I remember him from RoboCop and tons of. I mean, he's such a recognizable face. I saw him in so many other things, but yeah, didn't often do a blaxploitation film.
I think he just recently passed. I think he just recently died. I think so. But I mean, him and Robo, it's so funny that years later you're looking at RoboCop and, man, that's King George. It's how iconic his little performance is.
Yeah, and he's like in Cloak and Dagger as well from the 80s,
Yes.
which was a big movie when Mark and I were kids, and that was just one that I rented a lot. And so like he yeah he's he, and that's the thing about this cast too, that is different from Foxy Brown, and we'll get into why in a little bit, but they spent more money on the cast for Foxy Brown because they have like an incredibly good cast. It's not just also Sid Haig coming in playing a henchman, and I love that scene between him and Bob Minor just outside the door where they're talking about working together.
Don't look so hostile, Studs. We're all on the same side now. You're working for us.
I work for the king. That's all.
Studs, need a manicure.
You need a shine.
Unbelievably cool scene. I loved the sort of tete-a-tete between the two characters. It's and he's Sid Haig is just having a blast. You never
Oh
see his
yeah.
Sid Haig having a bad time.
No. Now they made six movies together. He and Pam made six movies together, and then Tarantino being Tarantino, the whole sequence of Jackie Brown with Sid Haig appears is like meta upon meta, because usually Sid Haig wound up dead. Pam usually killed him in her movies, and now he's sentencing her to prison in Jackie Brown, and the big dollhouse song is playing in the background. And it's I seem to be the only person who was old enough to kind of love this scene. I was like giggling in the theater when I saw Jackie Brown, and people were looking at me like I was crazy.
He's happy she's going to prison. Listen, look
Exactly.
at
Finally, I got you, Pam. Finally.
Well, in the end sequence in Jackie Brown, when they do the whole heist stuff, he uses the score from Coffee. Like his love for this movie is real. And if you haven't seen it and you want to watch this movie, like you're going to see a lot of what Quentin Tarantino was into, because this movie is a huge influence.
And it's the first pretty much blatantly anti-drug blaxploitation film, because you know Superfly was kind of the opposite of that, although it's anti-drug on the soundtrack and you know pro not pro-drug, but certainly it makes drugs selling drugs kind of sexy. Superfly does, because Gordon Parks Jr. was a photographer like his dad, and he really made a gorgeous looking film. That whole montage, just probably one of the more controversial sequences in blaxploitation, the montage where everybody's snorting cocaine. And Superfly, in the original, it was so controversial at the time because it looked like a commercial for cocaine. And in the remake of Superfly, which isn't that bad, they do the opposite. They actually make the montage about the selling of the cocaine, which takes the immorality out of the film altogether.
Got it.
But, you know, so Coffee becomes like one of the first, and that message carries through with a lot of blaxploitation films, that drugs are bad. Drugs are bad, okay? Like Mr. Mackey says in South Park. it comes through in a lot of the films. Before that, it really was either nonchalantly, you know, they are pro drug. Coffee is, again, kind of brings that to the forefront. And, you know, Pam Grier always was, in all of her movies, the four movies she made for AIP, the message about drugs that, you know, the drugs are bad completely. There were no positive drug messages in any of the movies that she made for AIP.
Yeah. And that's, it also carries into Foxy Brown as well. And I love those moments. And Jack says that this is actually was stuff that was in the script, because, of course, he was not able to edit the movie outside of doing a rough cut, because AIP didn't want to pay him to work on there. They would have to pay him more to continue to work on the movie. And they were very strict about budget. It's both movies are made for $500,000.
And that's all you got. John Sayles told me when I interviewed him that if you... This was with Roger Corman and with Sam Markoff. If they gave you a budget and the budget was X and your movie cost X times plus $1,000, that $1,000 came out of your pocket.
Oh, yeah. There was no going over. There was no over budgeting. Roger also wouldn't reshoot. So if you didn't get it right, make it work. Because he would not pay to reshoot.
That really had a big impact on Battle Beyond the Stars.
Yep.
Yes.
There's a whole sequence. There's a whole sequence of front screen projection stuff that James Cameron had drawn that they worked on that didn't come out right, and they wanted to reshoot and asked him, like, "These are really good. We should reshoot this and make, because it's going to really work. We just need to redo it." And he was like, "No, we don't reshoot. We move on." So they just dumped it. They didn't use any of it.
No. And James Cameron, remember that? And that's what made him a megalomaniac. No, just kidding.
that took time. It cultivated over years.
The seeds were planted, though.
But yes. But yeah, I love the moments where you kind of get a inkling of what Coffee is thinking when they just have those little flashback moments. And apparently Jack said that was in the script, but I love that you have those sequences, and I think it really... It helps give, there's already, I think in the difference in Coffee and Foxy Brown is Coffee has such a like very straight narrative. Like, you know exactly what she's doing from the get-go, and she has a mission and she's on it. But seeing like her think about like killing the guy in the very beginning when she's with her boyfriend, and you're just seeing those moments, like she's playing those things again in her mind. I think that I love stuff like that. You just so rarely get to in movies like see what somebody's thinking about, you know, like that's always like a guess. And this movie, I love those moments when you get to see what she's thinking and what she wants to do. And she's wrestling with her whole mission. She's basically wrestling with and trying to justify it in her head. And I love that element of it.
Yeah. I can't think of another movie, and I'm sure you guys will think of one as soon as I say this, but to your point, where you have a clear mission, and the mission is good. It's the right thing to do. In order to get there, though, you have to do some things that are very, very bad. And you rarely have a lead character wrestling with the morality of it to the point where she's trying to like ask her boyfriend, she's trying to ask people like, but have you ever had to face this kind of like, in order to do what needs to be done, you've got to do some things that are really wrong. And how do you, like, is that okay? Can I through talking with someone else, rationalize what I've done to myself. And that's you don't get heroes facing that morality, that wrestling inside in other movies. And to your point, Ryan, it made it for that first quarter of the movie, she's really struggling with, like, is I've done something very bad and I can't sleep at night, but I also can't stop what I've started. So now what?
That's the beauty of, I mean, again, him trusting Pam to be able to act those scenes out of these. This is almost post-traumatic stress disorder. You're kind of seeing here. And you're seeing her question, you know, I know that this is the right thing in my mind I have to do, but now that I've done it, what have I wrought? And you see this a little bit, very little in Death Wish, which is made after this, after Paul Kersey shoots the first person, he goes home and he throws up. Because these people aren't really killers, you know. Pam Grier's character is wrestling with all of this stuff, and she's having these nightmares and thinking about what did I do. And it's, you don't get that in most movies, let alone an exploitation movie that is a cheapie, if you will. You don't really get that kind of psychological insight into the hero.
Yeah.
Plus,
yeah.
it's not lost that her profession is a nurse.
Yes.
Someone who's responsible for helping people heal and getting over their trauma. And now she's inflicting exactly what in her profession she's trying to stop.
Yeah.
Yep.
There's more complexity to it.
There's another aspect that Quentin took, because he makes a character in Pulp Fiction be the nurse. In fact, the character that he plays in the film, his girlfriend is a nurse. And that's,
yes, Bonnie's a nurse. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's from Coffee. That's why he utilized that. He takes liberally from this movie.
And of course, yes, and Marvin doesn't have a head.
Right.
Also, they're trying to dispose of a headless body.
Yeah.
You know, so it does tie together very, you know.
Yeah. he takes a lot from Coffee. I mean, there's no, I mean, look, he created a store called Pam's Coffee.
Exactly.
I mean, he's wearing it on his sleeve. He's not hiding
for sure.
It.
Yeah.
Oh, Meg, you don't have any salad.
Pam does a lot of her stunts. She does have a stunt woman who fills in for her, particularly in the scene where she does race across traffic on the freeway. That was not Pam.
No.
But can I ask about that scene? And I did some research, but I couldn't find anything. Like, did they stop the freeway? Was it like the 105 that was being constructed, or were they like, go run out there?
It's like Bowfinger.
It is. Which is a hilarious
I'm not kidding.
Scene. Yeah. No, you're right.
That's why it wasn't Pam. Pam would have run across the freeway, because that's just Pam Grier.
Yeah. Well, also, Jack was saying he wouldn't have put her in that position. I mean, she's the star of the movie. He's not going to have her run through traffic.
Well, Gordon like Parks had Richard Roundtree walk. I mean, that scene in Chaplin, he's almost run over by the cab, just like in Midnight Cowboy. That wasn't scripted.
Yeah. No.
That actually, he just said, you know, this is the, and that's the first shot of Shaft.
Yeah.
First thing he shot was him walking through Times Square.
Yeah.
And so he would have been run over. He would be no Shaft. You know, Shaft would be, you know, I don't know, James Coburn or something.
Boy, that would be a very different movie.
That she does do stunts, but not running through the freeway. And I don't know if they did. They did use, I think, the closed freeway because they were building it at the time. So that's how they shoot some of the scenes where they're driving on it. But in terms of her running across, he doesn't say other than on the commentary, Jack, other than to say that it's not Pam.
Right.
So
yeah, it's just when you see the shot when she's first going to run across the freeway and you see the traffic, those cars are moving freeway fast.
Yep.
And I'm thinking, wait a minute. Is someone legit running into a freeway on this shot? Because it looks real.
That would be my guess. You know, yeah. I mean, like Odie's saying, I think that that's just for real what they just did. And I know they used a lot of, they got permits and stuff to shoot in a lot of places, but I'm sure there's a lot of stuff they didn't get permits for. And I think one. They just set up the camera and said, go run.
Well, that's how you save money in these movies. You know, the big car catching on fire in Sweet Feedback, they set the car on fire, and the fire department came. That's the real fire department. Like they didn't get a permit to burn the car. So they burn the car, and then the real fire department comes, and Melvin Van Peebles shoots the real fire department, putting out the fire.
Wow.
That's a
Wow.
movie too that we'll get to, Sweet Sweetback, because New World did release it. Several companies did, but New World was one of those that did release it for a time. It's not something that Roger talks about very often. I don't know why, but there's a story there of why. I don't know what happened. I don't know if there was something between him and Melvin. I don't know, but he did release it for a short period.
You know, and Jack Hill also put his people behind the camera in roles in Coffee. His stuntman is in one of the bad guys. He's the one-eyed bad guy that Pam runs over with the car in the movies. He's been in several of Jack Hill's movies as a stuntman, and he got his on-screen role here. I think this is the only one that he's on screen as a character, not as a stunt person in that. And he kind of pointed that out when I was doing research, that he wanted to put his stuntman wanted to have a scene in the movie, so they made him a character. And he wanted to get run over by Pam Grier, which, to be honest with you, I'd like to be run over by Pam Grier too. So
Yeah,
whip this one-eyed boy out too. Come on, Jack.
he sets that character up really well, and he says he shows him so prominently in the club there because he wants you to remember him when he comes back later. But I mean, that guy has such an iconic look, like you don't forget him, you know, even though there's a great distance between when he shows up and when he comes back.
That's presence.
Yeah, and then one of the best dummy deaths is him getting just plowed by that car. Only I don't know if it's topped, but slightly maybe topped by the dummy death in Foxy Brown with the airplane. I mean, that's pretty amazing. I have to say, I know Jack is not as thrilled with that, but Callum brings it up in his book and says, like, I love that part, and Jack's like,
Well,
yeah,
that's
I
where
always thought that kind of
everybody
looked
cheers
bad.
in Foxy Brown for that. And they cheer. I mean, they're like, oh, we didn't expect that.
I mean, that to me is pretty amazing. When you cut to the shot of him screaming, and then this is the body getting chopped up in the propellers, it's like, that's kind of amazing. I mean, it's kind of undeniable. It's a great bit.
Then Charles Bronson ripped that off for Breakout.
Oh, really?
Oh,
Really?
yeah. Shot, one of the most shocking things to happen in a PG-rated movie in Breakout is the guy gets hit with the propeller, and they
That's
actually show
true.
it.
That's right.
That was a PG movie, and I don't know, MPA was asleep or something, but Foxy Brown is most definitely rated R.
Well, that was also made at that time, and I mean, it's the 70s movie, and at that time there was G, PG, and R.
Well, the PG was cool back then.
PG was there's a lot you could get away with in a PG movie
Oh,
in the
yeah.
70s and
Well,
80s.
you had it in Raiders of the Lost Ark too, which was when the guy gets hit by the propeller, and
The
that
end
was
with all
part of
their
the
faces
impetus, and
melting. I
that was
mean,
part of the impetus for the PG-13 rating, because at that time, I remember critics starting to say, we need to get another rating system here because PG is showing a lot more than what should be a PG movie.
And that's
You know,
Temple of Doom and Temple of
well,
Doom
Temple of
then.
Doom kind of was the thing that was one of the big movies that were making it happen. Spielberg always got away with gory violence in PG-rated movies. Look at Jaws, for example. But Raiders was rated R. And what happened was what they did was they masked the guy's head exploding at the end of the movie. That's what got it a PG. So when the people's faces melt off, you see that very prominently. But when the guy's head blows up, it's masked. So you kind of only see it kind of not in its full. Originally, it was full like a scanner's kind of explosion, and that got an R. So they had to actually go back and re-edit Raiders of the Lost Ark. Speaking of editing, Michael Kahn started his career in blaxploitation. He edited several movies. Struck Turner, Spook Who Sat by the Door.
Oh man.
Struck Turner, Spook Who Sat by the Door, Trouble Man. He edited Trouble Man. And
Great
Black Belt
movie.
Jones. He edited four of them.
Wow.
Black Hole Jones. We talked to Jeff Scheckman, and I know you talk with him for the book.
Oh, he's awesome.
Yeah, he's great guy, and he
He's got a
worked on
lot of
Black Belt
knowledge.
Jones. Yeah, he's man, what a career. What an amazing career that guy had.
So I have a question for you about Coffee while we're on the subject of Coffee and Foxy Brown, because the tone of both of these movies is different. And I said in my book that I thought that Coffee it was almost nihilistic. I mean, I think it's probably one of the meanest, nastiest of all the blaxploitation movies. She's one of the toughest heroes in blaxploitation because she takes no prisoners and kills people real good. But I found like I was conflicted at the end of the movie because now she's come back and her boyfriend is cheating on her, and it turned out he tried to have her killed. And she shoots him, and that's a great stand up and cheer moment. But then she walks out, and there's that again, that shot I talked about at the end of the movie, where she's walking away on the beach, and it's like she's basically lost everything. And so Roy Ayers is on the soundtrack singing about how righteous she is, but I'm kind of conflicted because, well, where does Coffee go after this? Of course, we know she went to Foxy Brown somehow, because Foxy Brown was originally a sequel to Coffee, called Burn Coffee Burn, if I remember correctly.
That's right.
And the AIP at the last minute screwed Jack Hill over and said, we don't want a sequel. So he had to kind of write it over on the fly, which is why it's not as well put together as Coffee. I'd love to read the original screenplay of Burn Coffee Burn to see what the continuation of her story would have been. It's why Foxy Brown doesn't have a job. Because she was supposed to be Coffee.
And I think that the boyfriend getting, I think that might have been, or if it all was something that was originally Burn Coffee Burn, that might have been her former boyfriend, who's the police officer who gets beat up. That's what it made me think watching it this time. I was like, oh, was that originally maybe going to be her boyfriend? But we'll get to that in a second. What was your question about Coffee?
So I wanted to ask you what you felt about the tone of the film. By the end of it, did you sense that as righteous and as crowd pleasing as it is, there's an undercurrent of kind of sadness that I think is predicated from when you've seen you talked about earlier, where she's going through her issues of what am I doing the right thing? I think that carries through to the end of the movie. I was wondering if you noticed that and what you felt about that.
I immediately thought, as she's walking away, I'm immediately jumping to a different conclusion, which is she actually going to get away with this? Now, she isn't part of the crime syndicate, and she's not the person who's going to her boyfriend, who is going to start campaigning to be a congressman. He's dead now, so he can't say anything. She still has her little sister that she ideally wants to get back to taking care of. She's just a nurse, so can they pin this on her? Is there, I'm trying to think, is there a police investigation? Does she go back to her apartment and now the cops are there and they're like, wait a minute, what have you been up to? But you're right, she's thrown her whole life into a whirlwind that you don't know, is she going to get away with this? Is she going to just leave everything, leave her sister? Just live another life? I don't know. And it would have been nice to see in Burn Coffee Burn them try to like reconcile, okay, this is what happened, and this is where she is now, and this is how she isn't in jail for killing all of these people.
I would agree with that. I think there is definitely a melancholy. I think there's at the end. I think it's not just the fact that the song kind of has is a touch somber, despite what Roy Ayers is singing about. But like, I think it's about the cost of what she's doing. I mean, she's weighing the cost the entire time, and in the end, I don't think she realized. Obviously, she doesn't realize that her boyfriend is a part of this conspiracy that she's trying. I mean, she's starting out with like just street hustlers, and she's trying to take them down. And as she gets more and more into it and goes undercover, she goes after some of the bosses, some of the main guys, and it turns out that one of those guys working with them is her boyfriend. I don't think she understands the cost of that until the end. And that scene between her and her boyfriend at the tail end, boyfriend played
Oh,
by
so
Booker
good. And Booker
Bradshaw, is
Bradshaw, yeah.
fantastic, and was influenced by Richard the Third, Jack said, because there's an element of Richard the Third who, he does all these nasty things to this woman, but he still convinces her to marry him despite all of the terrible things he's done. And so there was that element to it, and Booker was a guy who had done Shakespeare and was a classically trained actor, and so he just said that to him in that scene and said, this is Richard the Third, and he was like, oh, okay, got it. So the scene, I think, is so good as he's trying to like make his case, And I think he probably would have gotten away with it if it wasn't for
That
the
woman.
girl.
Yeah, that's the question I was going to ask is do
Yeah.
you think, because you don't really know and you're starting to believe in that scene that she's, she says you were always a good talker,
Yeah.
but
Yeah.
she's starting to be persuaded. Like you can get the sense that she's like, well, maybe I'm willing to put this aside. I mean, I'm projecting my when I say this,
No,
but she could
sure.
you could see maybe who she rationalizes like, well, I've done some bad things too. So maybe we can figure out a middle ground how we can be together. If that woman hadn't shown up that he's been sleeping with, do you think she would have maybe considered giving him another chance?
I think so, because I think she's wants to believe what he's saying.
And what else has she got?
Right.
Think
Yeah.
about
Yeah.
what else does she have to kind of go with. She's in love with this man who she thought was doing good for the community, but is actually the opposite, which winds up being a trope in blaxploitation, the turncoat black person that you think is doing good for the community turns out to be the worst in the man. So I didn't think about Richard III, but now I'm remembering the line that Richard III says about that woman. He says, "I'll have her, but I'll not keep her long." That's the line that he says about this woman that you're talking about. So it's wild. I mean, there were a lot of Shakespearean actors who did blaxploitation. Obviously William Marshall, and Rowntree was in the Negro Ensemble Company. All these people were actors who were actors with a capital A who just didn't get opportunities to make these movies. There's Life on the Stage. Zara Cully and Sugar Hill, and of course Mother Jefferson on the Jeffersons. She had been working, for years. William Marshall had been working for 30 years before he played Blockula. So these actors who people were saying, well, they're downgrading their talent by appearing in these movies. They use an opportunity for them to actually act, and to show they can act.
You're just selling out to the white gangsters and businessmen. You're worse than they are. And I loved you. I loved you so much.
You still do, baby. You know it. And I love you. And we're gonna do big things together, baby. Because you're my woman, Coffee. Now, maybe I have done a few bad things, but that's the way the world is today. Sometime you have to do a few little wrong things in order to do one big right thing. And that's what I'm trying to do for you and for our people, that one big right thing.
You always were a good talker, Howard.
Let's go on to the next one. Foxy Brown, again, made for, like I said, about the same money, but this time around, Jack and Pam command a bigger paycheck. So it's actually made for less money ultimately.
Yes.
When Foxy Brown comes to town, all the brothers gather round, 'cause she can really shake 'em down.
Foxy lady, Foxy lady.
Pam Grier, that one chick hit squad who creamed you as Coffee, is back to do a job on the mob as Foxy Brown.
You tell me who you want done, and I'll do the hell out of it.
This is definitely a movie where Pam is now a star
Yes.
because the
Yep.
opening credit sequence is designed all around her.
James Bond style. Yep. The
Which Jack
costumes.
did not dig,
No, he didn't like that.
and he
With the
didn't like the
whole,
costumes.
no. Jack, you were wrong.
Yeah, I think he's conceded since that he's a little wrong. Like, he knows people like the costumes and stuff, but he wanted more of a timeless quality, which I do think he achieves in Coffee. I don't think Coffee can entirely escape the fact that it takes place in the 70s, but I think he has more of a timeless quality, whereas like some of the outfits that Pam wears are very much,
Of the 70s.
iconically 70s,
Yes.
I'm thinking about that, the costume she, the outfit she wears, that blue ensemble that she wears to basically yell at her brother because he's I mean, it was like, what an outfit to go confront your brother over him turning in your boyfriend. Like, it's just
Yes. The cinema, the choreography by Anita Mann and the costumes by Ruthie West, in the opening of Foxy Brown, and you have her song by Willie Hutch singing this song. So it's kind of Pam Grier becoming a package. Yes, and you know, she is a fashion icon. Tamara Dobson did it first with Cleopatra Jones, all those outfits she has on in the film, this black glamour you get. And so now Foxy Brown is kind of, I remember Jack Hill says something to the effect that we dressed her in whatever she wanted to wear. We let her wear whatever she wanted to wear. And then Arthur Marx said it for Friday Foster, which obviously she's a fashion model photographer, so she has to look somewhat nice. That's the movie, that's the biggest clothes horse Pam movie. But this one kind of you're gonna get her getting some more glamour into Pam, and having her model these costumes at the beginning of the movie. You know, clothes are a very big deal in blaxploitation. Of course, in the 70s, whether you like the styles and the colors or not, this was, you know, something very big. So by having her come out at the beginning of the film and model everything you're going to see in the movie with this kind of James Bond thing, like you said, that was new. And again, think about it. We have to look at the context of this is a woman, a black woman specifically, but a woman in general who is getting this treatment on the screen. And keep in mind, again, I bring this up, this was not happening to women of any color in the 70s. So that the nature of Pam Grier is bigger than just that she was a black star. She opened the doors for a lot of women to kind of make these changes and be like Pam Grier, an action hero who can get dressed up.
It For on the New World side, they end up making TNT Jackson, I think,
Yeah,
because of
which written
these
by Dick
movies.
Miller of all people.
That's what he had come to Hollywood to be, was a writer.
Yes.
And he actually meets Roger early on, comes out to LA, wants to become a writer. And he meets Roger and he said, "What are you? You're out to LA, what are you here to do?" He's like, "I'm a writer." He's like, "Well, it's too bad because we need actors." And he's like, "Well, then I'm an actor." And so
He's been Walter Paisley forever.
Yeah, exactly. And he's been so many iconic roles. But yeah, he was that's what he came out to LA is to be a writer, but he didn't write many movies, but he does co-write TNT Jackson, which is wild to think about. It and if we had such a straight narrative with Coffee, what we get with Foxy Brown is, well, at the very least, a lot of ideas. There's facial reconstruction, we talk about drug addiction, we talk about infiltrating a harem, trying to reunite an escort with her family, and then lastly, some revenge. Just
And the reuniting of Catherine Loder, whom I love, and Pam from the Big Dollhouse. You mentioned the snake in earlier. The snake is coming from Catherine Loder in the Big Dollhouse. Lucien, the torturous side piece of the evil lesbian warden, a new feature in a prison movie because they didn't have side pieces back then. They were just a lesbian warden chasing the prisoners. So Catherine Loder is in my I said my Mount Rushmore of black blaxploitation villains. She's up there with Shelley Winters and Cleopatra Jones and Lieutenant Uhura in Truck Turner.
Who is incredible in Truck Turner?
So
Oh my
good.
God.
I saw
So
Truck
good.
Turner before I saw Star Trek. So let me tell you.
The
I had
range.
no precedent. See, most people came to the opposite direction. I'm like, shit,
I
me,
did.
that was me. Not me. The opposite. I'm like, oh, it's Dorinda. That was her name, Dorinda. You know.
She is so good. She even puts Yaphet Kotto like on notice in that
When
movie.
you're in the movie with Isaac Hayes and Yaphet Kotto, and the scariest thing in it is you, that's saying something.
Unbelievable. Her
I
performance
was
is
afraid for
so
Truck
good.
Turner.
I love Truck Turner. That movie is
Oh,
so
I love
good.
that movie
Oh
so
man,
much.
one of
The
my
Jonathan
favorites.
Kaplan's movie there, Truck Turner. I love the story that he, you know, because Hicksploitation runs in parallel to Blaxploitation. I love Hicksploitation movies. He got the job in White Line Fever because they thought Truck Turner was a trucker movie. And he just said, yeah, it's a trucker movie.
You bet
Yeah,
it
sure it is.
is. Oh, wow.
I don't know what it ended up coming from Burn Coffee Burn and what they ended up now. I just know that Jack's always been he loves coffee. He's not as into Foxy Brown. I'd love to know what you guys think about the two movies like paired together as we have. But a large part of it was, as Odie had mentioned, in between the movies, Jack has mentioned this many times. He was not good at playing the Hollywood system.
No.
In between Coffee and Jack and Foxy Brown, I almost said Jackie Brown, Foxy Brown, he's invited to a screening for Dillinger, which AIP is putting out,
John
and
Milius directed that, didn't he?
Yes. And he walks out of the screening. Now, in Callum's book, he talks about it, but what he doesn't say, he only says in the commentary on Foxy Brown Blu-ray, he mentions that he said his stomach wasn't feeling good. So I don't know if that's some editorializing, but in any case, he walks out of Dillinger. He's not interested. And Dillinger's what AIP thinks is going to be their big hit. And so he walks out, he basically becomes persona non grata at AIP because they're like, well, to hell with that guy. So, and he thought, I'll walk out, nobody will know. But they did know, and they were upset with him. But then Coffee becomes a huge hit.
And people want a sequel.
And so they're like, well, all right, let's get Jack and make another one. But they decide AIP that they don't want to do a sequel. And they give the name Foxy Brown, which, as Jack says, it points out, well, turned out to be a great title, but it was not what he was going to do. But now he names the character Foxy Brown, but it's very clear that there's something lacking in this one. It doesn't have the through line. It doesn't have the specificity that Coffee has. It's a lot more loose, and it's sort of more like things happening, and Foxy Brown is sort of taking care of things. It has a great opening where she saves her brother.
Great car. Big
Great,
car.
great, great car. Her brother, played by Antonio Fargas, who most people know from Starsky and Hutch.
Huggy Bear.
Yeah, and but who was in a lot of blaxploitation films.
He's in almost everything.
Yeah, he's in a ton of stuff. And she saves his life only for him to sell out her boyfriend. I think the fact that this movie has a boyfriend who was a government agent and now has a brand new face, that's a lot for any movie to have to. That's a huge. That's a huge plot element that is just really just sort of just handled like, here we go, got your new face.
They also don't really describe what his face looked like before, so you don't really have a frame of reference of can he totally disappear into society with that face? I don't know. Maybe.
And the answer is maybe if her brother had just shut up about it and not put two and two together, but he does. And then she gets he basically gets him killed.
That phone call, that was one and very important phone call. That whole movie rides on that phone call that her brother
He didn't
makes.
answer the phone, we have a different movie.
And from there, that's when she's like, okay, she doesn't kill her brother, but she does dress up very well to go deal with him. But she threatens him, sort of, or at least I don't know what she was trying to do. I think she
Well,
handles.
I think she's trying to save him because had he listened to her and left town, like she suggested, he wouldn't have been killed in the end, perhaps. Spoiler, if anybody hasn't seen it.
Well, it
That's
happens early
51 years
on.
Should we have said spoiler alert before we started talking about all these, just in case there was somebody like myself that
mean, these movies are 50 years old. So, like, I mean, if you haven't gotten to them,
still catching up.
The
There's a lot of
Titanic
catching up
sank.
to do.
Spoiler
Spoilers for the movie Titanic.
I actually had someone write me and yell at me about that, by the way. That's why I made that comment. Someone yelled me, spoiler alert, like the Titanic sank in 1912.
If you see a movie called Titanic and you think that they're not going to deal with the sinking like
Well,
that, that's just that it's just going to be about the initial days of the voyage,
So me being mean, I wrote that person back, and I just was like revealing everything. Rosebud's a sled, and Norman Bates' mother, and I just went to this whole list of, it's like big FU letter to them, and I think in some ways Foxy Brown winds up being a big FU letter to Arkoff, to AIP. See, I've read different interviews with Jack Hill, and he's kind of been of two minds about it. I mean, he's proud that it was a huge, huge, huge hit that was more influential than Coffee, even though Coffee is the better movie. But at the same time, it's kind of like when people talk about actors who they work with, they never want to work with again, or a director they never want to work with again. The movie they made of May might have been a masterpiece, but they never want to go through that experience again. And the movie is a reminder of everything that went wrong at AIP with this. And I think that's why there's a bit of tender bitterness to Foxy Brown. I think that's why he said, as revenge, I wanted to make it as violent, as nasty as possible. That's kind of, he goes, in some ways, he said he told Josiah Howard, in some ways, I kind of regret that the movie's as violent as it is, but I was mad.
Well, he succeeds in making it really violent and really pushing the limits. I mean, and you have some interesting, I mean, he pushes the limits in a few different ways. One of the things that really I was kind of captured my attention, and you guys could tell me if you've seen this in other movies, but I don't remember a movie earlier than Foxy Brown that introduced a lesbian bar. I mean, that's bold for the 1970s to introduce that into a movie.
I mean, there were characters who were coded as lesbians, obviously Mommy and Cleopatra Jones and a bunch of movies of Roger Corman's ilk that have characters who are either coded as lesbians or outright lesbians themselves, but not a bar. No, this is one of the, I can't think of a movie before that where you actually had a biker bars with kind of coded lesbians in them. Yeah. But this is an outright lesbian bar.
There's Peter Hyams's Busting, but I think that's around the same time, which isn't about a
This is that's
lesbian bar,
73,
but
so I mean that's pretty
yeah,
close
it's pretty
to
close to more they go to a gay bar, which you can we could debate on another podcast whether or not that movie ages extremely well from that,
No.
but you know.
Shaft does.
Yeah.
We don't Shaft ages well because he's at the gay bar, and not only is he at the gay bar, he's the bartender, if you pay attention, pats Shaft on the ass. He says, good luck, and he hits Shaft on the ass, and Shaft kind of laughs about that. And I said, the original Shaft is less homophobic than the remake they made in 2019.
It's true. It's
Very
true.
true.
But yeah, there is some like bold things in this movie, Mark. I agree. And there's some very fun stuff in this movie. I wish the storyline had and Jack is always, was has had had this happen many times in his career where he didn't quite have enough time and money to really do things the way he wanted. But that he was upset a lot with the script for Big Dollhouse, but he would rewrite it every night before they would shoot the next day. And I kind of wondered, why not do that for Foxy Brown? Like it wasn't quite where you wanted it, so but you wrote it, so like you have the opportunity to change it. And this one it just but I guess whole cloth changes of like making Foxy have more of a like a plan and more of, a direction might have been too big an
Well, yeah, they
ask.
would have to rewrite the entire screenplay because if you're looking at this as a sequel to Coffee and the whole Catherine Loder element, as much as I love Catherine and Steve the love bug, that's coming straight out of Cleopatra Jones. The Catherine Loder character is basically coming out of Cleopatra Jones, great as she is. But I mean, it's like he basically is kind of pulling pieces together. And it seems more written on the fly than Coffee does. It seems like seat of the pants filmmaking where we need to do something. We have to add this element. Pam adds some elements. He adds some elements. Some other actors add some elements to what they wanted to do. And again, it winding up being more influential. I mean, with you think QT loves Coffee? He loves Foxy Brown even more. The whole violation sequence is in Kill Bill, Volume One. Jackie Brown's Foxy Brown name of a character. So many scenes and ideas from Foxy Brown wind up in Jackie Brown in one way or another. And so it's interesting. Inga Marchand named herself Foxy Brown the Rapper. So this movie is so much more influenced than Coffee, despite being a lesser film than Coffee. And I think that's kind of where Jackula is proud. But I think that him doing this on the fly probably took something out of him. And he was tired of having to be constantly have his movies kind of either not taken on time or pulled away from him. He gets the frustration. I think it really shows in the film. But it's so much fun. It moves so quickly that you look at it in retrospect, you're seeing this. While the movie's going on, you're just going with it.
That's true. And we're not talking we're not discussing one of the major spoilers of the movie if you haven't seen it. But she ends up handing Catherine Loder her boyfriend's dick in a jar. So I mean,
And
so
one of the
good.
great kiss off lines of any movie, she said, Catherine Loder says, why don't you just kill me? And he says, death is too good for you, bitch. I want you to suffer. And I'm like, man, that is cold.
It is.
What's even colder is the audience's reaction. I've shown Foxy Brown. I introduced Foxy Brown when they did the Blaxploitation Week and they sold my book at Film Forum. That was the introduction movie, was Foxy Brown. And when that happened, people, the audience is like, yeah, fuck her. I'm like, okay.
Whoa.
She is a really great villain, though, and
She's
that deep voice. I mean, it's
I
just
love her.
perfect.
She's great in Big Dollhouse too. She's very underrated.
But I like her better in this. I mean,
I agree.
She commands the screen at any time that she's on. A perfect foil to, you know, Pam Grier's character. Like they're both very strong. They're both leaders in their own respective groups. Again, you know, women being the highest tier of authority in these movies, and they play off each other perfectly.
I like the way she looks. She's thinking, you know, she's looking at, what am I going to do with this bitch, Foxy Brown? And she's looking at the screen, and you're like, what's going on in that head of hers?
But what do you guys think about Foxy Brown versus Coffee? What was it for you? I'm on Odie's side. I think Coffee's the better film, but I'm just curious what you guys thought.
I liked Coffee better. As we've discussed, they're different. They're very different, but I think Coffee, I found it stuck with me more. Like I thought about it more. I'm still thinking about it, and I, you know, still thinking about even that we talked about the final scene on the beach. And I think when you think about in your mind, like, oh, walking on the beach, like it's kind of romantic, and you think you go there either with someone you care about to have some sort of kind of romantic walk where you go to think or you go to. And so to have that movie end on that was very thoughtful and surprising to me as seeing it for the first time. I'm like, wow, well, that's not how I thought this where I thought this would go. And this would be what it ended. I was like, oh, like I started to roll credits. I was like, what? They're going to just leave us like this? They're going to just. I'm just being left with this. And I think Foxy Brown is fun and wild and shocking. And I think you made a great point, Odie, of saying that when you're in it, you're like, whoa, whoa, whoa. But when it ends, I didn't feel it leave with me. I didn't kind of take it with me. Whereas Coffee, I'm still kind of thinking through it.
Yeah.
I agree. I think it takes a lot of wild swings. I think there's it's a good movie. I would absolutely recommend anyone to watch it.
And for sure.
The ending, the introduction of the plane, like it goes to some wild places.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like it clicks. Like it just doesn't click like Coffee does. Right. There's some loose ends. Like when this movie ended, I thought, wait, okay, so her friend in the green dress who was worried that she wouldn't get back to her son. Mm-hmm. Did she get back to him? Cause like she runs away and we never see her again. Yeah,
we don't know.
Did she get back?
You hope.
What I'd happened? Like to think so.
Oh yeah. Right. Juanita Brown, who's in a lot of blaxploitation movies. And I described her in my introduction to Foxy Brown as you'll know her because she's acting her ass off and she can't act.
It's a great
Friday Foster. She's outrageous. In Friday Foster, her character has to act walking down a catwalk with a knife stuck in her back. See, Eartha Kitt is so scary. She makes you rather like still do your modeling, even though someone has just killed you. You're going to walk out. Eartha Kitt's going to find you in death. I got you. You know?
Yeah. For Jack's coming part. Back. For Jack's part, he says that Coffee is better because, quote, Foxy Brown is more of a play on themes as opposed to Coffee, which has a very strong and powerful emotional core to it. And that is because I had time to work on the script. So that's what he said in Callum's book. And he certainly, as we've mentioned, as Odie was saying, he prefers Coffee to Foxy Brown. But I think he's pleased that it did so well and it has become such a cultural touchstone, perhaps even more so than Coffee is. It's sad to me, too, that we had such a wild movie. And then at this point, after Foxy Brown, that's it for the Hill Greer films.
Yeah.
That's it for their, you know, partnership. Not only that, but he doesn't work with Sid Haig ever again. He, of course, tries to bring him into Sorceress, but Corman won't pay his fee, which is a shame because we really got denied Sid Haig playing Pando.
Pando?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He was going to be,
He's going to be Pando in Sorceress, which is, That would have been something. That
You could
really
write
would
a
have been
book
something.
on, yeah, you could write a book on things. And I mentioned in my book every so often, things that never got made that I would pour some out, like, you see, pour out for your homie that died, pouring out things that the one that's on topic here is Pam Grier and Tamara Dobson, after Coffee and Kelly Jones made $2 and $3 million respectively at the box office in 1973 money. I always point this out to people. It made $2 million when tickets were $1.50. And you could sit in a movie all day and watch it seven times and only pay once. Repeat business. This is bigger than if, with Lord of the Rings making $2 billion, because you can only watch Lord of the Rings once in the theater. You had to leave. They were going to do a Thelma and Louise kind of movie together. These two black women, a movie with two women as the lead in an action movie did not exist. And they were going to do it, and Pam Grier was going to write it, and she and Tamara, who were friends since 1969, were going to make this film. And nobody wanted to finance it, despite the fact that they had made two of the big box office movies of 1973. And I said, this is of all the movies that I researched that never got made that I mentioned in the book, this is the one that stabs me in the heart, because if that movie had gotten made, what would have changed about how actresses were, could the roles that women could get in movies? This, and it's just breaks my heart that that was kind of the case. So this is in a similar vein. I think you read a whole book on things that were in, pitched and never came to be, that you lament and never made.
Yeah, and that is a heartbreaker, because that would have been great. And she and Tamara were very good friends, so I think that would have been a heck of a project. But she does go on. She makes several more movies. Obviously, The Arena. She does Friday Foster, Sheba Baby. She does Grease Lightning. She ends up being doing some TV. She's in Roots, Miami Vice,
She's
Crime
in Fort
Story,
Apache with Paul Newman.
and then she does Fort Apache, The Bronx, and gets kind of a gritty role in that movie, and gets to kind of really kind of start changing her the way she's looked at and the way she's perceived in the 80s, trying to get more like serious acting roles. Always probably one of the first things I saw her in was Something Wicked This Way Comes. She's incredibly frightening in that film, and she starts to really kind of show different sides of herself. But the fact that she doesn't work with Jack again is I just find to be a real bummer. That said, Jack doesn't really direct anything after Sorceress, and he also doesn't direct another thing for AIP, so this period of Jack's career ends. And so, where does he go from here? Well, we will find out in our next episode of Corman Graduates, when we talk about the next two movies that Jack makes. Odie, thank you so much for being here. This was terrific. It was so
Thank
great
you.
to
Thank
chat
you.
with you.
Yes, thank you.
Thank
This
you so
was.
much for having me on. And when you do Rock and Roll High School, call me.
And like everybody, please get Odie's book, Black Caesars and Foxy Cleopatras. This is like a, if you like these movies at all, if you like exploitation in any way, you need this book. It is excellent. It is very funny. I laugh out loud while reading this book. It is
Thank you.
so funny. It's so, well researched, so informative. So definitely pick up that book. What do you have going on, Odie? What do you have next? Where do you want people to know about you?
Well, I am, if you're in the Boston area, and I'm not, but I will be in Boston. I'm doing a seminar at the Coolidge on Inside Man, a Spike Lee movie. Kind of
Oh,
goes with the
love that
new
movie.
Highest to Lowest. Inside Man was the last movie that Spike and Denzel made before they did it. 19 years later, they're doing Highest to Lowest. So I'm going to do Inside Man. I love New York City heist movies. I'm doing that. I'm introducing movies on the 30th, the Pam Grier movies, two Jack Hill movies, Coffee and the Big Dollhouse at the Film Forum in New York. They're showing three Jack Hill movies that day, and they're also showing Foxy Brown. So if you're a Jack Hill fan, come out to that on the 30th of August. And that's pretty much what I've got going on in terms of that. I'm the film critic of the Boston Globe, so you can read me there every week. And I'm just pitching my book as whatever I can. And also the Shout series, which you mentioned, which contains the movies you talked about. I'm on the documentary on both of those, talking about several of the movies that we talked about today and some that we have not.
And do you have another book in mind that you were?
I'm trying. I have a couple of ideas in the fire. I'm going to start throwing around and see what happens. It's a little nerve-wracking, pitching a second book, to be honest with you, because the first one gets published and you're like, well, what do I do? It's everybody's sophomore, jinx. So I'm like, what do I do here? My third book is going to be the one that puts me on the map, because that's my little my little Peyton Place book I wrote about my life as a programmer. I wrote
Okay.
a book before this. I've kept track journals and everything on my 35-year career in tech.
Whoa.
And that's my
Wow.
third book. And so
Wow.
that's the book that's going to make me, the
Write the
billion
second book because
dollars.
I really want to read this third book. So get this
I gotta
going.
write this second book real fast now. I gotta come up with
Yeah,
something. You're not the only one that wants to put this third book out because
yeah.
I name names. It's a Ramana Clef. And there aren't many books about a black programmer working his way through 35 years of IT. I don't think of any
Yeah.
like that.
No. Yeah.
And I worked at a lot of big banks and saw a lot of. I said, this is going to probably be the dirtiest thing I've ever written. And the running joke is that everybody's getting laid except me, which is pretty much real. You'll know it's real because I'm not embellishing the story because I'm the only one not getting any.
Well, that sounds terrific. I look forward to what your second book is, and can't wait to read more of your writing and see you pop up on more documentaries. You're obviously a great voice for this genre, and we're just happy that we got you on, and hopefully we can talk to you again somewhere down the road.
Thank you. Thank you so much again.
All right, that is it for Corman Graduates. We'll see you next time. If you want to hear all of our episodes, you can go to our website, newworldpicturespodcast.com. That's where all of our episodes live, also our articles, and also t-shirts. If you want to support the show, you can buy a t-shirt. We got a bunch of different designs, or you can just tell a friend, write a 5-star review. That's how you can help support the show. We'll see you next time on the New World Pictures Podcast, part of Someone's Favorite Productions Podcast Network. Bye, everybody.
Thank you for listening. To hear more shows from the Someone's Favorite Productions Podcast Network, please select the link in the description.
Are you a film fan who loves the ultimate home video experience? Look no further than The Disconnected. Your host, Ryan Verrill, is your go-to source for the latest and most accurate information on home video releases, exclusive interviews with industry insiders and filmmakers, and has established a thriving community where every film and physical media enthusiast feels welcome. From hidden gems to blockbuster hits, The Disconnected brings you insider knowledge and a welcoming space to share your love of cinema. Watch every Thursday night at 9:30 Eastern, 6:30 Pacific for the live announcements show and follow The Disconnected on social media to stay updated. Subscribe to The Disconnected on YouTube or on the podcast provider of your choice and dive into a world where every movie night is an adventure.